welcome to Nightside on 720 WGN, broadcasting from the greatest city in the world, Chicago, Illinois. My name is Eric Rung, and with me is Paul Lisnick. How you doing, Paul?
Hey, Eric, how are you? It is good to shed our ties and shed our roles over on the TV end and get to just have fun on radio for a while.
Absolutely, and we're going to get to some news and have some fun here tonight. But first, before we go any further, how was your holiday?
You know, it was good. I didn't go anywhere. I stayed here because I was doing
all
these.
Working.
I was filling in. I was actually doing a lot of sessions of the opening bell, which, of course, is at 5 a.m. here on WGN Radio. So that was always fun. Kind of the business end of things and doing some fill-in on CLTV. But every time I turned my television on this morning, there you were anchoring CLTV.
Yeah.
And then you're doing the, news here. I think by last count, you haven't slept in 3 days.
I love the news, Paul. What can I say? Yeah. I've been up since 2:30 a.m. So wow. this could get weird tonight.
This could get fun.
But our first guest is actually fantastic. He is a two-time Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for the New York Times, Adam Goldman.
How many Pulitzers do you have at this point?
I think it's still kind of coming.
They're voting.
The paperwork has been put in.
The vote hasn't happened yet.
I expect it pretty soon.
Okay.
I mean, any day now, really, I would suspect. But we are going to have some fun tonight. What else we got?
We are, because actually, after Adam, which would be really interesting, that'll be our touch of politics this evening and law. Chris Jones, the phenomenal, I think he's one of the best in the country, the Tribune critic, theater critic, Chris Jones, has a new book out called Rise Up. But we're going to talk about the book. We're going to talk about the best theater in Chicago. Was it a good year? What's coming up in the future? There is nothing this guy doesn't know about theater. And actually, I once said to him, you know, Chris, you and I agree about 95% of the time on theater. And then he said on the air to me, the other 5%, Paul, you're wrong. So that's the incredible Chris Jones. And then after Chris, by the way, a special musical guest.
Yes. Well, let's save that. Let's just put it. We teased it already. But
A little bit.
Yeah. But first, we definitely have to go to a break. And then we're going to come back and we are going to talk with Adam Goldman. He is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winning reporter for The New York Times. We're going to really dive into the Mueller investigation with him. That's next on 720 WGN. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Nightside on 720 WGN, broadcasting, of course, from the greatest city in the world, Chicago, Illinois. And Paul, I am very excited for our first guest tonight. It's Adam Goldman. He is a 2-time Pulitzer Prize winning reporter with the New York Times, who covers the FBI. Adam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's a real honor.
Well, let's just dive right into what is the, I would say, arguably, the biggest story of the year, which is the Mueller investigation, which you have been covering since it began. Where are we, do you think, in that investigation? There's a lot of reporting, or not necessarily reporting, but there's a lot of rumors out there that it's getting close to coming to a conclusion.
Yeah, that's certainly the reporting out there, that it's in its final innings, maybe the seventh inning stretch. But I think Mueller himself realizes there's some sense of urgency to wrap this up. And, you know, we're waiting for a number of things to happen. We know that he is targeting an individual by the name of Roger Stone. So we're looking for that case to be either prosecuted or not. And a couple of other steps too. But before we get to the end of this thing, I think he's got some T's to cross and I's to dot. And I think it's the common understanding that, you know, these guys, the agents and the prosecutors are writing furiously to finish this report.
You know, Adam, your focus is DOJ and FBI, that kind of law enforcement piece of this. And I find it interesting, as somebody on my end who covers politics, that when you see Trump supporters talking about this, all they keep saying is, well, and including the president, no collusion. There's no evidence of any collusion. But isn't the proper answer to that, really, we have no idea what evidence Mueller has? There may be tons of collusion or none. We don't know.
Yeah, Yeah, well, let's just keep in mind what Mueller set out to do, right? Mueller's appointed to investigate, you know, Russian interference in the 2016 election, and, you know, whether Trump or his associates conspired with the Russians in any way to meddle in this election. And he's charged with investigating crimes, right? And we've seen the results of this investigation, the many indictments, the charging of, you know, Flynn, his national security advisor. I mean, just think about what's happened. It's pretty extraordinary, right? He successfully prosecuted his campaign chairman, right?
Right.
His national security advisor, right? Michael T. Flynn, who lied to the FBI while in the West Wing, in the White House, lied to the vice president, lied to Sean Spicer, lied to, you know, Trump's then chief of staff. And, you know, you can go down the list, right? And, you know, I think what he has uncovered is some pretty unseemly behavior from people who surrounded the president. I'm not sure, look, the public is wrapped up with this idea that, you know, a successful special counsel has to uncover collusion or some sort of conspiracy. But I don't think that was ever my expectations were he's going to uncover crimes. And if there wasn't a conspiracy, well, then, you know, then that wasn't a crime and he wasn't going to uncover it.
Well,
we needed to have an objective, independent, an impartial investigator who was insulated from politics to get this job done.
Right, and we definitely saw how a special prosecutor where an investigation could take them. We saw that during when it started as a Whitewater investigation with Bill Clinton. So this definitely can go in a lot of different directions. Some news of the day. Go ahead.
Yeah. I don't necessarily think we've seen that. I think he stayed within his mandate, and he and his prosecutors are smart enough to know that, you know, they've uncovered crimes and they've referred them to districts like in Virginia and in Manhattan and in Washington, D.C., and those prosecutors have tackled those crimes. It seems that Mueller has very much stayed within his mandate and hasn't, in fact, gone off the rails.
Well, not necessarily off the rails, but when he has uncovered other things, that's a good point to make, that he has went ahead and moved those investigations to different prosecutors and not stayed with them himself. But news of the day here today, can you talk a little bit about the court filings that came out today talking about a Russian troll farm that references nude selfies? What is that all about?
Well, I have to tell you, we're still trying to figure that out, and why there is a nude selfie. I mean, there could be a whole lot of reasons behind that. If I had more information, I'd put it in the newspaper and I'd share it with you. But I really can't go beyond what the public knows.
But what we do know that Mueller has whatever idea he has, he knows what's going on. I want to ask you, Adam, as well. You know, right now, Whitaker, the guy who is the acting attorney general and soon his replacement, have been very public about the fact that they are against this Mueller investigation. They've said those things, but Whitaker has decided not to recuse himself. He doesn't, you know, he doesn't see the conflict, and I'm guessing nobody the president appoints will recuse themselves. My question for you is this: having again focused in on these areas, if that report comes out from the Mueller team sometime next year, maybe it's February, that's the rumor, maybe March, who knows? But whenever it comes out, if the attorney general or acting attorney general decides to put it in a drawer and kill it, what are the alternatives? How does that information come out, or do we have to rely on, at that point, a democratically controlled House?
Well, I think you could see there are two things that are going to happen. A, you could see what happened in Watergate, right, where prosecutors working with the grand jury sought permission from the judge to make that report public to Congress, right? Because remember, Mueller's just not writing a report. He's using a grand jury to investigate, right? A grand jury is, in effect, an investigative tool, right? The same tool was used during Watergate, right? So, and now we have this playbook that several weeks ago was finally made public, what that grand jury did in Watergate and how they managed to get that grand jury report to Congress. So Congress Congress could be informed. Whitaker, if Whitaker or his successor, Barr, if they in any way try to bury this report, you can be sure the Democrats in the House are going to subpoena this report. I would also say, you know, if Whitaker tries in any way or his successor tries in any way to limit Mueller's investigative step, the special counsel rules, regulations, require that Congress be informed of that. And one other alternative here too is if there is a lengthy court battle to get Mueller's report, guess what? Congress can just get Mueller, the prosecutors, and the FBI agents who worked on this thing to testify behind closed doors in Congress.
But you know,
and you know.
Well, you have here, I'm going to take a little twist to this, which is, I think it was Geraldo, the great prophet Geraldo, who once said, had Fox News been around when Nixon was president, he may never have had to resign. So given your analysis, and I get it, add in the Fox News component, which of course has been shaping the marketplace, certainly for 35% or 40% of the country. And then secondly, you have that piece, and then you have a Supreme Court with a couple of Trump appointees. Now, of course, Chief Justice John Roberts has said we are not Trump justices or Obama justices or anybody else. We are impartial judges of the law. But that being said, if you're looking outside, looking in from your perspective, it looks kind of stacked against Mueller in terms of ultimate decisions, doesn't it?
Yeah, certainly in terms of impeachment, because what the president, you know, has been very successful at in his proxies and allies, Devin Nunes, you know, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Sean Hannity, you know, from Fox News and others, you know, what they've done is successfully try to discredit this Mueller investigation, right? Lower public confidence, right? So, you know, Trump's core base and perhaps others believe that this is a witch hunt and a partisan and an investigation that doesn't have legitimate roots. And, you know, that's going to make it difficult for Congress to move forward with any sort of impeachment, even if they find a high crime.
Well, and then you have Giuliani, of course, on television saying
brand strategy. By the way, you make a great point. It's been a brand strategy. I mean, it's obstructing the investigation from outside of DOJ, FBI. You know, you've got Hannity, you got Trump, and you got their allies in Congress. You know, chipping away at the public's confidence in Mueller's investigation.
Yeah, and what I was going to say is you also have Giuliani who flat out just said, you know, we need to just win the public's mind, and then we can move on from this, too.
Yeah, and, you know, Rudy can say that, of course, and that might be the case when the Dems take control of the House shortly. But, you know, the president's been implicated in a couple of serious crimes in Manhattan and, campaign finance violations, which are both felonies. And it seems that the prosecutors there have a very strong case, strong enough where they put it in the Cohen plea papers. And, you know, if Trump loses in 2020, he can't escape that. He's going to find himself in the same position as Bill Clinton, right? Make the deal with us, or we're going to charge you, right? And what was the deal Bill had? He had to apologize to the FBI, admit he lied, and he lost his law license, right? So, you know, Trump might escape impeachment in 18, but if he loses the White House in 2020, he's not going to, he's just a man, and it seems unlikely he's going to escape the wrath of federal prosecutors there.
But, you know, just to complete the circle, there's one thing you left off. If he wins re-election in 2020 and the DOJ stands by his policy that we don't indict a sitting president, the statute of limitations, as I understand it, will run during the time of his second presidency. The only thing that could get in the way of that would be if there is a sealed indictment now. Can you explain that a little bit?
Right. Yeah, you know, there's statute of limitations on these charges. You know, the clock starts ticking from the time the conspiracy ends. I guess maybe that would be late. That would be sometime in 16. But yes, they could. Yes, to get around that, they could do a sealed indictment, and charge the president. And as soon as he, you know, at their time in Tuesday, they could unseal the indictment, which could, in fact, be, you know, if he went to 2024.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be certainly extraordinary. I mean, in that Rudy can say whatever he wants.
Sure.
I mean, Rudy can get out there and blather on about this.
Well, that's his job, really.
Attorney. Yeah, that's his job, right? His job is to be the Fox commentator of this team and to sway the public against this. But the fact of the matter is, Rudy is not going to stop, you know, federal prosecutors from moving forward with their case if they think they have one that, you know, allows them to charge the president. And, you know, let's be clear, sealed indictments aren't an unusual tactic in DOJ. Sealed indictments happen all the time, right?
All right, Adam, we're going to get into that in a moment. Our guest is Adam Goldman. He is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter from the New York Times. We've got to take a break for news. We'll hit you back on the other side of this, Adam. Good evening. Welcome back to Nightside on 720 WGN. My name is Eric Rung. I am with Mr. Paul Lisnick, and our guest tonight is Adam Goldman. He is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter with the New York Times who covers the FBI and the Department of Justice. And Adam, I want to pick go a little different direction here with our conversation. Just how much of this investigation changes when the Democrats take over?
Well, in what sense? What the Dems are going to look at?
Just where the investigation goes with the Democrats in the House taking over that committee. Especially, I mean, one thing that comes to mind right away would be Comey coming back. He wants to testify in open session. That's something that he wasn't able to do when the Republicans were in charge.
And all the transcripts that have been sat on by that committee, which now the Dems want to turn over to Mueller and his team.
Right. I mean, I think you're going to see the Dems, Adam Schiff, who will chair the House Intelligence Committee, release all these transcripts, these dozens of interviews, some of them probably which won't be that flattering to some of the folks who appear before that committee. You know, I'd be surprised if the Dems brought Comey back up to the Hill to testify. There's some aspects of this they want to move on from. You know, the Republicans are still focused. You know, they're obsessed with Hillary Clinton's emails. I mean, obviously, they're not going to continue. It's like the Benghazi. You know, it's the new Benghazi, Hillary Clinton's emails. So they're going to probably move on from that. I think what you're going to see the House Intel focus on are the president's covert wars, right? What the military has been doing, in Africa, in Yemen, and other places, right? Because we ceded a lot of authority to the CIA, and Joint Special Operations Command. I think the Dems probably are going to take it easy on DOJ and FBI. Are somewhat sympathetic to their plight these last 2 years, but they are going to do vigorous oversight on what happened to DOJ under Sessions, right? And decisions he made. You can be sure Whitaker's going to come up and testify, right? Mm-hmm. The acting attorney general, he's not escaping that. I mean, he's going to come up and testify, and we'll have to explain why he hasn't recused himself from this. He's going to face a lot of hard questions.
Adam, let me ask you a question about this is kind of maybe from 1,000 feet up as we're looking down. Yeah. Again, you know DOJ and FBI so well, and I work with a lot of those guys and train them. So here's my sense. It looks as though the Mueller investigation and his colleagues are surrounding the Trump, not the foundation, but the Trump corporation, doing a good job of surrounding that corporation. And you're either a witness or you're a target. And it looks to me like all the witness spots are taken.
You can be a subject. You can be, there are three. You can be a witness, subject, or target.
Well, yes. My question to you is this. While we're talking about Roger Stone and these others, do you have any sense that what may also happen in 2019 is a Mueller charge against one or more of the Trump kids, group of kids, and maybe in the Southern District? And of course, if it comes out of the Southern District, that raises the question of whether a pardon will work. Does that look like that seems to be on the radar to you?
I don't know. I mean, you raise a great question because, at least in the case of Michael Cohen, I think that begs the question what the Trump family knew about those illicit payments, right? And did they sign off on any of them, right? How involved were they? But like you mentioned, you know, that case being around the Southern District of New York and Manhattan. So that wouldn't be Mueller per se. You know, if Don, you know, the people, people have talked about Don Jr.'s testimony before Congress.
Yeah.
If he misled Congress in any way, that could have been referred to Mueller, or that could be referred to the U.S. Attorney's office in D.C. You know, that could be on the horizon. I think also there are some mysteries out there too. Early on, Mueller gave a guy by the name of George Nader, some form of immunity. It might have been limited immunity. And Nader was a Lebanese Emirati citizenship too, who was basically the bag man for the Emiratis, right? And the Emiratis, the Saudis, and the Qataris were spreading around a lot of cash for a lot of people, right? And we don't know where that is going. And who might have accepted money, what FARA, you know, Foreign Agent Registration Act rules were foreign lobbying rules were violated. I think I wouldn't be surprised if we saw some of that in 219 in terms of charges.
I also wonder that if we did see some charges closer to the Trump family, it's hard to imagine, hard to predict how the president would react. You know, we talked about Watergate a little bit earlier, Whitewater Watergate. But back in the Nixon days, of course, the way Nixon had to step out was when Senator Barry Goldwater, after seeing the scheduled indictment, went to the White House and said, "Mr. President, it's time for you to go." It was his own party who essentially said, "You're done. You've got to go." I don't see that happening here. Do you?
No, I mean, it seems like if federal prosecutors in Manhattan are going after the family, there's nothing Trump can do about that. What are you going to do? I mean, you can't fire line prosecutors, right? What people also don't understand is, you know, the FBI agents working on Mueller's team or for these U.S. attorneys. I mean, the case, you can't make the information go away, right? It always stays with the FBI. It always stays with these federal prosecutors. You just can't wash this away. If they go after his family, you know, it seems like the most likely route would be through federal prosecutors in New York. So I just don't see how he stops that. What's he going to do? Fire line prosecutors? The president can't fire line prosecutors. He could fire the U.S. attorney running.
Exactly.
Southern District.
Well, you could also just say if you don't fire him, then we'll fire you, and just kind of do the same thing that Nixon did too.
Yeah, but you know, what would that precipitate? I mean, these would all be foolish moves now by the president, because if the thinking is that we're at the tail end of this thing, the Mueller investigation, then why would you want to do anything to upset that if you're close to the end, right? And I think that's one of the reasons, by the way. You know, I think that's one of the reasons why I think some would say that's one of the reasons why he never fired Rod, right? Because firing Rod would have caused incredible political damage. And I think he understands firing Mueller would have done incredible political damage. I mean, he said, "Don't go after my family." It's a red line, but they've already moved in that direction. I mean, how many red lines do they need to cross, right?
Well, you also have to, by the way, he also probably recognizes that firing Comey is what opened up all of this. I mean, that's what really triggered all of this, including Rod and the special prosecutor. Maybe he realizes that step wasn't the best move, regardless of what people think about Comey. But to take out Rod Rosenstein or one of the other ones, you're right, opens up the next Pandora's box.
Right. And I don't think, you know, all, you know, look, the president had every right to fire Comey, but you know the mistakes. Many of these mistakes. You know, the president finds himself in hot water because these are self-inflicted wounds, right? You know, he had said he didn't like the way Comey handled the Hillary Clinton investigation, and in the press conference and the letters of Congress, that he should have fired Comey January 21st, right? Mm-hmm. And he shouldn't have written a 3.5-page memo referencing the Russia investigation, right? But you're right.
Tell that to Lester Holt, too, in an interview.
Yeah, and then, of course, you know, right, and then, you know, then the FBI's sitting there, they're like, wait a minute, he just fired Comey. He references the Russia investigation in the letter he gives, you know, to fire Comey. They're like, what's going on? Is he trying to obstruct this national security investigation and, you know, that's looking at Russian interference? And then he gets out on television and he tells Lester Holt, yeah, I did it because of Russia. And they're like, well, okay. The FBI's like, okay, you told us. Yeah. Now we know. It's really been incredible to watch the president, inflict his own damage on, you know, he's his best, he's, you know, some would say he's his worst enemy, he's his best promoter, but he's also his worst enemy, right?
Well, there has to been a lot of times, regardless of political affiliation or whatever, that a lot of people sit back and watch this president and see some of the moves that they make and just, and continually say to themselves, Wait, what just happened? I mean, that's had to happen a lot in the last couple of years here, especially, I mean, as a reporter, as anybody watching this president, he's so unorthodox in just about everything he does.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, you know, the first year covering this was just chaotic, right? And, you know, we were thrust into this environment in which none of us had ever experienced this before, right? Because, you know, what you typically find when you cover the White House is a very cold and calculating. Obama was the same way, right? Very smart, thoughtful, calculating approach to dealing with the media and policy, right? I mean, the idea is you don't want to do anything to generate bad headlines, right? But, you know, Trump doesn't seem to be concerned with that at all. And you know, shoots from the cuff and these major decisions he makes. It just seems as if he enjoys the turmoil. But for us, it's confounding and exhausting because we're just, you know, he's a bouncing ball and we've got to follow every bounce, right?
Yeah, give
him credit. He's got a lot of energy.
Let me tell you, to take the politics out of it for a moment, as a lawyer, yeah. Jeff Sessions was right to recuse himself. I mean, that just as a lawyer, ethics, he did the right thing. And yeah. Whitaker, of course, has been advised to also.
Jeff Sessions was heavily criticized, right? But when it came time to do the right thing, he did that. He recused himself.
Right.
It was the right call to make.
So my question is, Whitaker, who's been advised by the Ethics Council to recuse himself, has decided he won't. If down the line there is questions, I mean, is there any recourse there? Is that just, once again, the House, somebody stepping in and raising questions about those decisions that he made?
Probably that's the only recourse. I mean, you know, somebody told me the reason, you know, somebody said, you know, why didn't Whitaker recuse himself? Because he went over there as a critic of the Mueller investigation. You know, he wasn't going to make the same mistake that Sessions had made, right? Sessions did the right thing and recused himself, right? Because it's the appearance of bias, right? You don't have to demonstrate. I mean, Peter Strzok, the FBI agent, has sent those texts. Mm-hmm. And the inspector general criticized the FBI agent, you know, criticized him and said, we can't, you know, before the appearance of bias, and we can't rule that out. But, you know, Whitaker was cautioned to recuse himself because of this, but he just decided not to. He assembled his own counsel and, you know, these guys he knows and, you know, decided he wasn't going to recuse himself. But I think what people would say and people I know would say is that he didn't want to make the same mistake as Sessions and, you know, he's willing to eat this bullet for the president. Right.
Adam, I got to tell you,
it's non-recusal.
We could sit and talk for our entire show here. Unfortunately, we do have to take a break here. Adam Goldman, he is the Pulitzer Prize winning reporter from the New York Times, covers the FBI. And Adam, we will be reading and watching what happens. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Adam.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
So what happens if we win?
I go back to France. I bring freedom to my people if I'm given the chance.
We'll be with you when you do.
Go lead your man.
I'll see you on the other side.
Here we meet again.
Boy, that song sounds kind of familiar, wouldn't you say, Paul?
Isn't that in a show or something?
Maybe. I'm not sure.
Maybe one of the hottest shows of all time?
I do know a person that can answer that question for
us. Me too.
Us.
Our next guest here is, we're so happy to have him. Chris Jones is the theater critic for the Chicago Tribune, also a critic now for New York papers. I read your reviews.
New York Daily News.
And he's here tonight to talk theater, but also he's got a new book out. It's called Rise Up. You see, Chris, that's why we let in with the Hamilton piece, right?
I'm guessing Rise Up. We know what we're doing here, huh?
Yeah. We know exactly where you got that title. It's Rise Up, Broadway in American Society, From Angels in America to Hamilton. I was so in love with his first book, which was called Bigger, Brighter, Louder. You didn't expect that plug.
No.
But it was 150 years of Chicago theater. It was a series of reviews from yourself and your former colleagues, Richard Christensen, and On the Way Back of Time. That one's out there. People can read it. Good luck trying to get a copy of Rise Up.
It's reprinted, man. It's reprinted. Get it on Amazon. $16 right now, Amazon Prime.
It's been backlogged forever. Anyway, I think you are the greatest critic in the world. We want to talk about theater. It's going on. I do have one question I've got to start with. Right? When you do the, when Chicago Tribune prints your New York show reviews, we don't get the stars from you. What's the reasoning behind that?
Well, I think the reasoning was that it's not local and it goes in other papers. You know, it's up for debate. You know, we don't usually rate Broadway shows, which we should really, given that we rate Chicago
shows.
Well,
you break trends. Why not?
Yeah.
I mean, people obsess over stars, you know.
Absolutely.
They don't even read it. How many stars? This is reductive.
Only if it's around four, then I'll go back and read.
Because, of course, the critic is like, oh, people want to read my great thoughts, my great analysis. But in reality, no. How many stars? That's all they care about.
Well, there you go. Now you just put four stars at the end of every column, and I'll read it for sure.
That'll increase your credibility. I appreciate that.
Well, I always tell you, Chris and I have talked about theater so many times, and I always tell them that you remember our line, which is you and I agree about 95% of the time on shows, and your response to me was... About the other 5%.
Well, you can't be right all the time.
Yeah, right. That's so I guess right. It was me That's you were right. referencing. We want to talk about the current theater.
Whenever people say that to me, I always go, do you think it's interesting to me that you don't agree with me? I say, you know. I'm always like, you know.
Well, you always stop on me on the street and talk politics. Why shouldn't we
do
this?
That's right. That's fair enough. That's fair enough.
Hey, Eric and I, we go to a lot of theater separately but together, and all the openings. And so we were chatting before tonight about talk about some of the greatest shows you've seen this year. And there's one that you didn't give enough credit to in terms of when you rated them. And I'm talking about Sean O'Regan's Private Peaceful because you decided when you rated them, you weren't going to put him in the category. And by the way, I talked to Shane just the other night and I let him know he was happy we were going to talk about
it. So that was this amazing show it's a one man show that no one had heard of. And I go there. It's called Private Peaceful and it's based on a Michael Moore Puglio novel, the same guy that wrote War Horse. And it was just about a guy who, it was a World War One soldier who it was sort of a show about cowardice, because in the First World War, as you know, in the British Army certainly, you would get executed for cowardice. And they would say, so if you got an order, you didn't follow it, then you would be shot at dawn. And what would you do as a soldier if some sergeant major said, you know, it's a suicide mission, just go do it. And it was, of course, their way of keeping order among the ranks. And it's a show about that. And, you know, it's not exactly a box office smash, that description, right?
But it was incredible. One guy played 40 roles, 24 different voices.
Incredible piece of acting.
And you were very upset that there were not a lot of people in the
audience. Right, and I did my damnedest to get more people there, and I'm proud to say I think I did. And I just thought it was one of the most extraordinary pieces of acting of the entire.
But it didn't make your list because you weren't going to include tryouts and...
That's right.
Right,
because it wasn't a Chicago show, technically. It had been in New York, it had been come from London, that kind of thing.
Right.
But it was a great piece, a great acting. I got more mail about that show than any other show.
Yeah, I thought it was amazing.
What were you most excited about this year? I mean, as far as some of the Chicago shows.
Well, I was really into Gypsy, which had an African-American woman, E. Faye Butler, who had spent the last 45,000 years trying to get a theater to let her play Mama Rose. And finally, at Porchlight, she managed to do that. And it was I thought it was a truly incredible performance. And I thought that was probably, one of the best shows of the year. I thought Bruce Norris's play Downstate, which was about sex offenders, in a group home in downstate Illinois was probably the most moving and powerful show of the year. And it was really all about, if you didn't see it, it was just a bunch of guys in a home in an unspecified downstate community. And they were all sex offenders. And the show wasn't saying they were innocent in any way. But what it was saying was that everyone is lumped together in the same guilty category. And have we reached a point where, you know, we know who we want to throw away in society and who we think of as redeemable? And it was sort of, it really confronted everybody in the audience on that topic. Do you believe that these guys in front of you are irredeemable? And it was a very, very powerful piece of writing. And I think it'll win the Pulitzer Prize. I'll say it right now on this show.
You're on the record.
I believe it will win the Pulitzer Prize. It was a superb piece of writing.
You know, when people think of Chicago, and we all think of the Broadway and Chicago shows downtown, those are the big, brash, wonderful shows, of course. And then there's that level of Steppenwolf, Looking Glass, Victory Gardens, Goodman Theater. But I think Chicago, you know the answer. I mean, when we compare it to New York, if we want to, when it comes to just the whole world of the number of theaters and the black box theaters, I don't think any city is like this. I'm not even sure New York matches up with all the theater companies we have here.
I think, you know, one of the things I always encounter as I go about my life, I've lived in this city for 30 years, and I meet a lot of people who don't go to the theater, you know, because I'm incredible as it may seem, and they always go, "What do you do?" And I always go, you know, I'm a theater critic, and they sort of go, "Huh?" And they go, "We got great theater in Chicago," or "Chicago." And I always go,
in your British accent.
In my British accent. And I always go, "Do you go?" And they go, no, I don't want to do that. But I'm always touched by how Chicagoans who never go to the theater, and I bet there are a few listening right now, are actually very proud of the theater in this city. Yeah. And I think they understand that other cities don't have it. They understand that that's what makes us not just receiving stuff from the West and the East Coast. It gives us our Midwest identity, and it's world-class work. And everybody knows that. And it's a unique thing to our town.
And as you know, almost any major show that comes to town, the Jerry Mitchell shows, all those kind of things, this is where they try them out before Broadway. I always talk to them on my backstage show about it. But why do you think that Chicago is the town they want to come to before Broadway?
I think, number one, it's the audience. I think what they find in Chicago is an audience that replicates the audience in New York to a large extent, at least in their minds, which means that they're sophisticated enough that they've seen a lot of shows, and they're sort of open-minded enough. But these shows are new when they come here. So if you look back at 2018, we actually had three major tryouts. Yeah. We had Pretty Woman, we had Tootsie, which is yet to open in New York, which I think will do well.
Yeah.
I thought that was great. Fantastic.
Yeah. I think that's gonna be a Tony contender.
And the third is Cher. And I have to ask you, you panned it, and you kind of panned it here, and then you loved it in New York. Did they listen to you?
Yes, which is why it explains that discrepancy. Well, if you saw the Cher show here, what they did here was they created the show was like a TV show about Cher's life.
Right.
And the problem was Cher had a TV show herself. So you had a TV show within a TV show, and everybody got lost. In New York, Cher comes out. Actually, there's three Chers. They all come out. They do the show. Cher runs the show. It's much better.
All right, we're going to have much more with Chris Jones. Welcome back to Nightside on 720 WGN. My name is Eric Rung. Paul Lisnick is with me tonight. And joining us in the studio is Chris Jones. He is the Chicago Tribune Theater critic. And Chris, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And you've got a lot going on here. Not only do you do your job with the Chicago Tribune, but you got a book out too. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so I've got a new book out. It's called Rise Up. It's with Bloomsbury. It's available from Amazon.com, just, you know, with a mere click away. And it's sort of about, it's sort of about the road to Hamilton. Like, Hamilton in my career has been the biggest show, the biggest news story there's been. Like, I've worked for the Tribune for, you know, 20 years. grand total of one review has been on the front page. You want to guess what review that was?
Hamilton.
Mm-hmm. and it's a kind of a phenomenon. In fact, my nephew Jude is here, and he's staying with me right now because he wanted to see Hamilton yesterday. So I sort of thought I'd write a book about what caused that. Like, how did Broadway sort of figure that out? And the reason for that really was, I was watching the Tonys in 2016, and if you remember that, it was the day of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Florida, mm-hmm. and there almost wasn't going to be a Tonys. And this was the time that, you know, Hamilton was supposed to win. And I remember watching the Tonys, and they up flashed a little video, and it was President Obama and Michelle Obama, and they were introducing Lin-Manuel Miranda, who, of course, would go on to win the Tony. And I remember thinking, I don't think that's ever happened in the history of America, that you've had a sitting president essentially introduce a nominee at the Tony Awards. And I thought to myself, even in, you know, people talked about how the Kennedy administration supported the arts. You know, Kennedy, Camelot, Jackie O, all of that. But Hamilton's relationship with the Obama administration was so much more intense and so much more powerful that I thought this became kind of the, you know, it was almost like Hamilton became the official piece of art of the Obama administration.
And you devote the last chapter of the book all to that story, and it sort of opens up where they play some songs in the White House, and I remember, and you've got the whole story complete, where the Obamas basically, when they hear there's a musical about Alexander Hamilton, basically say, good luck with that.
Right.
And then, of course, they got hit with it as well, and you take it all the way through Lin-Manuel Miranda's incredible speech for his victory. It was no surprise he was going to win.
Right.
And I know he wrote a sonnet for his wife, but you noticed that he realized, because of the Pulse massacre, first of all, in their performance, no guns, the muskets, those were taken out. And then he turned it into something that will forever be remembered.
He got up to the microphone, Paul, and he said, basically, love is love is love is love is love is love. And I don't know if you, how many of you listening to this were listening to that moment, but it was the perfect, I was like, how did he figure that out? How did he know how to capture that moment? Because it was such a raw moment. And, you know, it was just sort of a remarkable thing. And I thought to myself, you know, this would be an interesting story. And then the other thing was, of course, that there was an incident with Mike Pence, who was the, of course, the vice president. So during the run, this is a really interesting thing, I think. As we know, Obama gets done, Hillary loses, Trump wins, right? And then what happens is that Mike Pence goes to Hamilton in New York. They see him from the stage, or they know he's coming, I guess, and they decide to address him from the stage. And they basically say, you know, hello, Mr. Vice President, we're glad you're here, but this, 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 and this, and we want you to do this, this, and this. And that was a sort of a remarkable thing. And Pence, if you recall, was sort of good sport about it, whatever, no problem.
He said to his daughter, this is freedom.
Trump
is the one that got upset
Trump,
about it.
Trump, however, gets upset. And he tweets the following day, theater should be a safe place. Apologize to this fine man, Mike Pence. Now, you know, I see the argument that Mr. Pence should have been allowed to have a quiet night in the theater. Now, I do actually respect that argument. I think it's a perfectly respectful argument. But I will say this, that if we now sit here knowing what we know about Trump's tweets, which have been a huge part of American history. The first really controversial Trump tweet was about Hamilton. So the tweeterama that is Trump began with Hamilton. That was the first thing he really, that got his goat, and he obviously sat there in his house and went, wasn't in the White House yet.
An incredible show, obviously, with the, it's interesting, even the other night on the Kennedy Center honors, it wasn't Lin-Manuel Miranda who was honored, it was the creative team of Hamilton.
Exactly.
That was honored. It was exactly the right thing to do.
Well, he's such a savvy dude. You know, I don't know if you've seen, his American Express commercial?
Yes.
So he
yes.
does this American Express commercial. Now, if you say, okay, Paul Lisnick's going to have an American Express commercial, you make it about yourself. Everybody does, right? Lin doesn't. He makes it about the show. So now he is essentially advertising Hamilton and American Express is paying
right.
for it.
And a little of In right. the Heights, too.
Exactly.
Right.
I don't know if you saw him on, you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Yes.
Okay. Did you see when he was on that show?
I did.
He played the exact opposite of what he really is in real life, which he was very selfish and all about himself. It was just an interesting juxtaposition on that.
Well, he is, you know, his image is so genial. Like, I don't know if you've seen Mary Poppins Returns, but he basically in that movie, he plays a really nice guy. I mean, and all he does for most of the movie is sort of smile. He sort of shrugs his shoulders a bit and he goes, and he looks after these kids, and he's a beacon of hope and shining beauty, and I'm like, dude, how did you get this gig where you're constantly this sort of a great guy?
You see him. I did a special on the Miracle Center, and he was part of it. And if you know the Miracle Center, an opportunity for young, primarily Latino youth to put on shows and all of that, and give them direction. And he is so involved with them and so supportive of them. So he is somebody who gives back. But I have to say, so the book kind of ends with Hamilton, and it's called Rise Up. But many chapters take us there.
Yes,
and you take us through the history of theater in a fascinating. I didn't know what to expect, and I was just been fascinated by it. The chapter on AIDS, which brings us Angels in America, is where things open. But I want to move you up. We opened up with some Lion King music.
Yes.
You have a chapter on Disney coming into play. And essentially, I love the stories you say. It's sort of myth, but the notion of how Disney even realized we better be the first on Broadway with our shows before anybody else gets there.
Well, I think that, you know, the story was that in the 1990s, you had a renaissance in Disney animation. And so these guys, Alan Menken and Howard Ashman, began writing these incredible movies, like Beauty and the Beast being an obvious example, but The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Tarzan, all of these great movies. And in the case of Beauty and the Beast, they wrote this incredible series of songs for what was basically a cartoon. And I think it was Frank Rich in the New York Times who wrote a column saying the best musical on Broadway this season, or the best score, was actually Beauty and the Beast.
From the movie.
And so Disney then set about putting, of course, this has all gone full circle because you've now got the movie versions of the live action musicals. But then Disney decided, okay, we should put Beauty and the Beast on Broadway. And they did that. And it was very successful. But their huge hit, of course, was The Lion King, which was, you know, they took a risk because they found this sort of maverick puppeteer woman called Julie Taymor, who really hadn't done a Broadway musical before. And she came up with this sort of incredible musical. And I wrote in my book a little bit about why I think it's successful. And one thing is, if you've seen The Lion King, you probably know that at the beginning, there's this huge parade of animals. And it's mind-blowing. If you've got like a 2-year-old in your lap, it's the greatest. You are happier.
How about a 42-year-old?
I've seen it. It is absolutely incredible.
Right. And it's counter to the normal way you do it, which is you have your big end. In Lion King, it's all in the first scene. And what happens then is that people relax and they go, well, my $195 have been pretty well spent. My kid is happy. And that, I think, had a lot to do with it. And it's just kind of brilliant. My other thing, everyone will indulge me for a second, is there's the idea that in The Lion King, you've got Simba, right? Who's the little, like, you know, everyone knows who Simba is. In The Lion King, you see him. He's an actor. He's a sort of a person. He's also a shadow puppet. He's a little silhouette at one point. And because the through line of the show is so strong, that doesn't bother you. You go, oh, that's still Simba. So if you imagine Paul as a silhouette, Paul as a shadow puppet Paul, if you make people believe that it's all Paul, it works. And that was the brilliance of that show in a nutshell.
The magic of Julie Taymor.
Exactly right.
All right. Our guest is Chris Jones. He is the theater critic for the Chicago Tribune. We're going to have more with Chris right after the break. Stay with us on 720 WGN.
525,600 minutes. 525,000 moments, oh dear.
Just an absolutely beautiful, beautiful song. Welcome back to Nightside. My name is Eric Rung. I'm with, of course, Paul Lisnick, and our guest is Chris Jones, who is the theater critic with the Chicago Tribune.
And Eric and I are having a great time, not on the TV side tonight, but over on the radio side. Chris has a brand new book out. If you've been having trouble finding it, and you have been having trouble finding it, I can promise you, it's called Rise Up, Broadway and American Society, from Angels in America to Hamilton, available on Amazon and bookstores. I know you, and some of the smaller bookstores and bigger bookstores. It's great. Anyway, So we've talked about Hamilton. The reason we opened up with Rent is because the book ends with Hamilton, but it opens with a chapter called The Angels Have Landed.
Yes.
And it really is the AIDS crisis. You deal with the AIDS shows, of which Angels in America you spend a lot of time with. And, of course, Rent. Talk about, and let's throw Normal Heart in there as well.
Yes.
Talk about this genre. Why you chose to open the book there as the starting point?
So I thought I would open with this play, Angels in America, which a lot of people know, which is from 1992, Tony Kushner, and it's all about, it's a play about politics and religion.
And just last season with Nathan Lane and Andrew Garfield.
Just last season on Broadway, that's right, with Nathan Lane and Andrew Garfield. And a very fine, very memorable production here, way back in the day. The first national tour began here, produced by the late Gitta Jacobs, who we lost this year, actually. But Angels in America, I thought, well, here's a play, you know, one of the greatest American plays of the 20th century, without question. And I thought, okay, that is a good sort of place to start. But one of the reasons was the play came out in the middle of the AIDS crisis. And I think what was interesting about that play was anyone who's around in the AIDS crisis, and this is, I'm speaking here, late 80s, early 90s, were going to a lot of funerals. And often those funerals had the same sort of pattern. You know, you'd find somebody who had died too young. You'd find a sort of alienated mother in the back of, I remember this vividly. I went to, Sarah, I bet you went to a few of these. And you'd find an alienated mother in the back of the church, and you'd find parents who did not know their sons in most cases. And what happened, I think, among sort of progressive thinkers like Kushner, who were really secularists, that is to say, they were writing plays about politics and not sort of poking fun at religion, but they were also going to so many funerals of people who died so young that they had to sort of strive for some sort of spiritual meaning. It's very difficult to go to funerals and be completely an atheist if you go to a lot of them, because you sit there and you go, there's just got to be something. And I think that was the era of Angels in America. It was the era of Larry Kramer's The Normal Heart. There was this amazing journalist who I know you know called Randy Schiltz, who was born in Naperville. And he created these series of books called, one was called And the Band Played On, that really dealt with that, the definitive history of that crisis. So I really wanted to write about all of those things.
Very powerful. And by the way, you also tell the story of the Tony. You know, I love when, or maybe I don't love when, theater and politics intersect, as you mentioned with regard to Hamilton. It was the Tony Awards, and former President Ronald Reagan had just died.
Yes.
And so did Tony Randall, the actor.
Yes.
And you talk about how that got handled on the Tony Awards. What do you do? Reagan, who was not great when it came to AIDS research support and all of that.
Right.
And Tony Randall often had a lot to say about that in his career. What happened on the Tonys?
Well, and effectively, Reagan's, you know, it's sort of remarkable how little was said about Reagan's death on the Tonys.
I believe in your book you said his name wasn't mentioned at
right.
all.
Right. Nothing. Yeah. Nothing. And that was just sort of symptomatic, I think, of Reagan's sort of the distance that was between the sort of Broadway community, the creative community, if you like, and Reagan. And it was really all about AIDS. And I think that was the sort of the number one issue. We forget just what was going on at that moment. And, you know, and then that led to this sort of musical Rent, which is sort of very famous musical all about, a lot of people know Rent, you know, one of the most successful shows in history. So sometimes people say, has there ever been a show like Hamilton that was that successful? And I sort of go, well, you know, A Chorus Line, and the musical, was on the cover of Time magazine when it first came out, but it was Donna McKechnie's legs. It wasn't a substantial story. It was still a big deal. People forget A Chorus Line was a big deal. The other very big deal was Rent. But the problem with Rent was was that anybody over 40 thought that everybody should just pay their rent. And it never really appealed to people over 40. But it was still a great show. And I in the book, I talk about how Rent for me was about gentrification. And there's a paradox, because if you go now, so the Rent was set in the East Village, which at the time it came out, the East Village in New York was still edgy. It was still a little dicey walking around late at night. No longer the case now. There's nowhere in Manhattan that's not a fortune. And in many ways, Rent, he had a show, Rent, that was railing against gentrification. And we have the same issue in Chicago, Paul, as you well know, right? And yet at the same time, it caused gentrification, because it made the inner city, the East Village in this case, seem cool. And so I thought that's a fascinating paradox. The show that was the most upset about gentrification actually did the most to cause it.
The parallel of sadness there, because we talked about Beauty and the Beast earlier, and of course Howard Ashman, who died early, but when it came to Rent, of course, the playwright passed away the opening night.
Yeah, right as the show is opening, Jonathan Larson passes away. I always think there are three people in the world of theater who died too young. There's more than three people who died too young, but there's always three that always come to my mind. One is Jonathan Larson, who died on the cusp of Rent, and you think to yourself, what else would he have written had he still lived? The other was Lorraine Hansberry, who wrote A Raisin in the Sun, great big hit, and then had a sort of follow-up with The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window. She never finished it. She died in a hotel room right before the show started. She was the second. And the third, this is might surprise you, but the third was a guy called Roger Miller, who is best known to most people for the song King of the Road. Trailer for Sailor.
I wonder if that's the Roger Miller you had.
And he wrote Big River, and then he died. And that's, you know, there's a lot of great artists just die right at the moment when they get great.
Chris, I got to ask you before, we're kind of running out of time here a little bit, but what should people be looking forward to here come 2019? What should we keep our eyes out for?
Well, I think we're going to have a good year. There's a few pre-Broadway tryouts knocking around that are not fully gelled yet, but I think we're going to have some exciting tryouts there. I think that's going to be exciting.
Dear Evan Hansen.
Dear Evan Hansen is coming.
That's a
February 13th opening.
Yeah, he knows it all. That's a big deal. I think that's going to be a great show. That's very, very interesting. And then if you're a fan of Donington Abbey, Mr. Bates from Donington Abbey is going to be in a solo show at the Goodman.
At the Goodman.
And it's a great play. It's called St. Nicholas, and it's about a critic, actually, and his sort of dark fantasies as he sits there night after night.
Can I quickly just ask you?
Obsessing about an actress.
You've got a chapter called The Immersion Power of the Solo Voice.
Yes.
Just very briefly, it has to be incredibly powerful when one person takes the stage for the entire show, has to command the stage.
Yes.
I think of Hal Holbrook as Mark Twain, who really created it. But it could be Lena Horne in Lady and Her Music. How powerful.
Well, you know, we had an example in Chicago this year with Stacy Keach, who effectively had a heart attack on stage. I mean, he really did. And he had nowhere to go. And that show continued. We're all sitting there. And he couldn't leave. And that guy, that was the most courageous thing I've ever seen.
I was not there that night. You were.
Yeah.
He began to sort of ramble.
He just sort of lost his place, and he would repeat text, and he went round and around and around, and you began to worry what was going on. And then finally a stage manager comes out and says, you know, thank you very much. And to his credit, he comes back and he did the show perfectly.
Amazing.
Yeah, unbelievable. That's what you call old school brilliance.
Incredible. So the power of the single performer then, as opposed to, I want to just the flip side to that for a moment, the ensemble cast, where you have to have everybody play along. I mean, you have Tootsie, where you have, you know, a star here and there, but then there are some that just Motown, you just need the ensemble to make it work.
Well, and I think, you know, if you look here in Chicago, we really specialize in ensemble acting. If you look at, say, Steppenwolf Theater, you know, you've got the play August Osage County, which is in my book, and it's about, there's a play. I remember being in New York at the opening of August Osage County, and I remember this New York guy next to me, and he kept going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And what he was reacting to was just the power of the acting that he was seeing.
Wow.
And it was kind of, you know, that's what we do. We don't mess around in Chicago, Paul.
That goes back to the power of Chicago theater. Tracy Letts, who wrote that show, and Superior Donuts.
And The Minutes, yeah.
Amazing talent, playwrights, actors that come out of this city.
And how we just don't mess around here. And that we're really in the business, that, you know, there's no glamour here. There's no, you know, fancy supper clubs. This is about telling it like it is in this town.
It's Chicago.
It's Chicago.
I always respected that John Mahoney, who we lost this past year.
That was a terrible loss.
You know, 11 years of Frasier, but he never lived in L.A., always kept his home right here.
He didn't give a damn for any of that. All he cared about was Chicago and good acting and being with his friends. Paul, he was the nicest. I've never known anyone, an actor, just as wonderful as he was. I just thought he was the most spectacularly beautiful man, you know. And his loss, I got one of the saddest days I had this year was I got this call from a reader who said, I want you to know that John Mahoney's belongings are being auctioned off in downstate Illinois. And I went online, and there they were.
So did I.
Tony, you know. Wasn't that sad?
Yeah.
I mean, I was like, really?
I bid on some items, too, but it was to really have a piece of his car. I did. Well,
You didn't get any.
No, I didn't. Everything went a little bit more than I, you know.
Yeah, right. But it was, there was just something, you know, dust to dust and all
that. Yeah. It's powerful. The world of theater is so great here. Let me recommend again, the book is called Rise Up, Broadway and American Society, from Angels in America to Hamilton. Very different than your last book, Bigger, Brighter, Louder. But what an incredible, if you're a theater lover in this town or any town, this truly tells a fantastic story. I couldn't put the book down.
Thank you, boy.
Chris Jones, I think you're the best critic in the country. I say that to you on air, off air. You know how I feel about you. I think you're absolutely amazing. And when we differ, you're wrong.
Honored to be here, guys.
Chris, thanks so much. Yeah. And welcome back to Nightside. My name is Eric Rung. This is 720 WGN, broadcasting out of Chicago, the greatest city in the world. And with me is Mr. Paul Lisnick.
Hey, Eric, it's great fun. We get to step out of the TV studio tonight and have fun in the radio world. And what we've got to do now is, you know, New Year's Eve around the corner. How many dates do you have lined up for that, Eric?
I can't say that on the radio.
Oh, you could. But listen, I think I'm staying home watching movies. But anyway, it struck us that that a lot of people out there may have questions about what to wear on New Year's Eve, how to look fashionable.
Not you, though. You don't have that question.
I don't have that question. No, right. I have a lot of questions about that. There's even, we got some horns, by the way, New Year's Eve horns. And also where to go, what kind of entertainment might be out there. So we thought it might be a great time to introduce listeners to some of the possibilities. So joining us is Mark Roscoe. He is the founder of Mark Roscoe Design, which is incredible in the work that he does for...
You've seen his stuff.
You've seen his stuff. Everybody's, I know, on Facebook. For women, it is just unbelievable. It's some of the most gorgeous women's wear I've ever seen. And a new men's line, Mark, is coming out, right? So that's coming out soon for men?
Correct, in March.
All right.
2019, Eli Roscoe.
Can't wait for that. Yeah, it's called Eli Roscoe with your partner, Dr. Eli Soto, for that. And also joining us, we have one of the brightest, best sort of singers, a Chicagoan, who you just catch all over the city. And I know, in fact, the night before New Year's Eve Eve, Blake Alexander, you will be performing. Where will that be?
I will. That's going to be at the Merchandise Mart. So I'm going to be starting at 7 o'clock.
You're also
I'm sorry, 8 o'clock.
You're also a man of many wonders because I know you've recently opened a restaurant.
I have.
And you'll be open for New Year's Eve, so I guess, are you going to sing at the restaurant?
I will be singing on New Year's Eve, yeah. We're having a big special that evening. So.
I love it. What's the name of the restaurant?
Blake Alexander's Hog Haven.
Hog Haven.
Yes.
It's our kind of food.
Where is it located?
Crown Point, Indiana, so 3838 West 141st Avenue.
So you're making the trip back and forth then.
Yes. I'm used to being in my car.
By the way, I got to say this because I took a look at like the menu for that night and whatever. That is like, you know, when you go out on New Year's Eve, you spend like hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
Sure.
I don't, but maybe you do, Eric.
For all my dates, would you add it all up? Yeah.
Exactly. But you know what? Let me tell you, you might want to take her here because can you tell us what you're charging that night? Because I saw it.
$20.19 to bring in the new year.
Unbelievable. Wow. 2019.
What do you get with the $20.19?
Bread.
Bread and side salad.
A cup of water, no ice.
Exactly. No lemon, no ice. So we're having two drink tickets. Tickets included with that, as well as a buffet from 7 to 9, and then I'm going to be entertaining from 6:30 until whenever I stop. So it could be 11:30, it could be midnight.
Depends when you stop drinking.
That's when I'm definitely going to stop singing. I probably won't start the drinking until about 11. So,
all right,
got a long
night.
Do
you have a certain genre that you go for?
I just kind of feel the crowd out, but I do a mix. I do all the, you know, the oldies, the standards. Then I do modern stuff, Bruno Mars covers, Robin Thicke, Michael Bublé, Sinatra, all the good stuff.
Yeah, I've always thought of you. I've heard you, and that's the flavor I have. Sort of that Rat Packy. You know, the folks who love music from the 50s, the 60s, mm-hmm. the 70s. You're right there with all that. But you're a young guy. What got you into that?
My grandparents. I spent a lot of time growing up with them, and that's just what they would play, whether it were in the car, on a cassette tape, or at home on a cassette tape.
Wait a minute. I love that work. Does that mean I could be your grandfather?
I don't know. I'm 25 pushing 50 or 60. So.
All right, Eric, I'm going to do the math on that, and you just...
you know I'm not going to do math. That would just be a bad idea.
But let's talk to Mark if we can.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You know, when we think about New Year's Eve, that's a special occasion. You want to get dressed up. I mean... maybe not go tuxes, but what should we be looking for here?
Well, I mean, holiday attire differs from the location of the party. It could be a black tie event, or it could be kind of a spinoff on a cocktail attire with a little festive twist to it, to the ugly sweater. I mean, it just depends what your host is.
Well, the ugly sweater thing, that for Christmas, that makes sense, right?
Well, there are ugly sweater parties even for the New Year's party.
Oh, so, okay.
But I mean, it typically is, you know, a tuxedo or an upscale cocktail look, which, you know, could be a nice suit and tie, and versus the tuxedo, the black tie look.
Now, I see you've got the jacket and the vest on underneath it with the tie.
It's radio. He wanted to look good.
Well, he definitely looks better than both of us. No question about that. But the vest is something that I kind of go back and forth on. For a guy my age, I mean, should I go vest?
You know, vests are very versatile, and what's really nice about them is if you take the jacket off, you still have a dressed-up appearance. And it also adds a different design element. And you know, especially for a holiday party, you could do something that has a little sparkle to it that jazzes up the look. Absolutely, it's an appropriate look for holiday, and it's an appropriate look for office, and, you know, casual with a pair of jeans. So the vests are coming back and you know, in pretty strong force.
Should you, on holiday time, is this the time, you know, I'm in Christmas time. People have just the strangest looking Christmas suits with trees all over them. Well, I shouldn't say strange. It makes them happy, so wear whatever you want. But on New Year's, I mean, is it sort of time? Yeah, wear the red, wear the black, I mean, bring out the color, or do what you want.
Well, you know, I think it's nice to add the holiday color, you know, the reds and the greens and more holiday hues. But I think, you know, a tartan, something that is a little bit more sophisticated for New Year's Eve, is a real nice print to pull in. I would stay away personally from the reindeers or the Santa Claus heads, but, you know, there's some really cool ties, cummerbund and bow tie combinations that have, you know, champagne glasses on them, you know, a smaller print that is a little bit more delicate in its look, that's still, you know, very classic looking. So
Eric should take those antlers off that he's wearing here?
Good choice.
So what about women? Are we talking ball gowns or what are we talking?
Well, and again, it depends who's hosting your party and what the invitation says. You know, oftentimes when you're invited to an event, they'll say black tie or black tie optional, or, you know, casual attire. And so
follow directions is what you're saying.
Follow directions, and if you're not sure, ask the host. And if there is no direction, then err on the side of a little bit more formal look, because no one's going to fault you for looking more pulled together. You know, but for women, you know, cocktail dresses, you know, sequins, you know, beading, that's all appropriate. You know, we're expecting more of a sparkle for a New Year's event.
Well, by the way, I know we're going to take a break, but I just have to notice. Do you notice Mark and Blake, they're both wearing pocket squares that don't match their ties? That's
well, now that I'm looking,
right,
now that
right.
You pointed it out.
Because
yes.
When I buy bow ties, I get them with matching pocket squares, and Mark, you've told me don't do that.
Sure, they should match. A complementary pattern or a complementary
color.
But they should not match
right.
Each other.
That was so scary.
All right, we do need to take a break. Our guests are Blake Alexander and Mark Roscoe. Thank you guys for being here. We'll be right back with more on 720 WGN.
Can you read my mind? Can you picture the things I'm thinking of?
And welcome back to 720 WGN. I'm Eric Rung, and with me is Paul Lisnick, and we have a very special guest coming on right now. Paul?
You know, Eric, as we were talking to our last guest, Mark and Blake, they'll be back, but we were talking about women's fashion and design. My mind, I kind of floated away, and I thought of elegance and elegant women, and I said, you know something? We need to just take a break and get one of the most elegant singers I've ever heard.
I like where your head's at.
On with us, don't you?
I love it.
So it is such a treat and pleasure and honor to have Rosalind Kind join us. And the music that you were just listening to is actually right off my CD. I've got one of her CDs called Come What May. She's got a new song coming out that we're going to talk about, a new CD coming out. She's performed on Broadway. She has been on television. She's in film. It's pages and pages of credentials. She cares about a variety of causes we're going to talk about. And her new release called Save the Country is now available on CD Baby. You're going to hear some of that, but as well, it is such a treat. She actually just finished touring the country, 8-city tour, international tour with. She has a sister who's also a singer, Eric. I don't know if you might know who her sister is.
Oh, try me.
All right, how about Barbara Streisand?
I think I've heard of her.
Yeah, I think you have. Joining us is the incredible Rosalind Kind. Can I call you Rosie?
You may call me Rosie, please. Please do.
Brooklyn-born, but living in L.A. now, Razi Kind. It's so good. You are just such a magnificent singer. And then when I found out that you had this new release coming up, and I thought, you know what? It very much is all about your view of the world. Things need to be done. Tell us what led to your recording Save the Country.
Well, I loved the song, and I did it several years ago in a New Age show that I did in L.A., because I wanted to share messages of unconditional love and getting people together. And my show at that time was based on learning to love yourself, one-on-one love, one with many, country to country. I wanted to always get the world together, but it always starts with loving yourself first. So I did a show, and then Save the Country was in that show. I haven't done it since then. That was like in the 90s. But with everything that's going on in the world today, I felt it was the perfect time to really try and get a great arrangement that's kind of out of the box that hasn't been done before and change my style a little bit for this. And because it's light, it's positive, but I just want to send a message of people getting together and not judgmental and learning to love each other. We all come from the same universal power up above. Every one of us.
You know, we all
down deep inside need the same thing.
As I listen to it, and I've listened to the song several times, Razi, I have to say what struck me is ordinarily you can look at a song and identify the genre that it's from, but this, I wasn't able to do it. I felt that this song was really expressing a variety of genres. It visited jazz. I mean, is that intentional? I'm right about that, right?
You are very right about that. And that's because, you know, it's a song that had been cut in the 70s by so many artists. And upon listening to all of them, it's a one-line message. You know, that's really what it is, and it's all in the music. And we had to come up with a way of doing it that nobody else did. And so we worked on this song for quite a while. We put this has our heart and soul in it. And we kept layering it, and we have some wonderful violinist and sax player and incredible performances on it, and we have so many sounds to make it interesting and uplifting.
It definitely spans, to me as well, a lot of genres. You know, looking at that song, you have a new album coming out. Are there more songs with the same message on this new album?
Well, there might be another one. There's a song, I mean, we're working right now on the fifth entry. We're not finished with it yet because we're working on it, and then we're going to put out singles and then build up to the CD. But there's a song on there which will come out that I wrote with my musical director, Michael Orland, and our friend Judy Quay in the early 90s. And I did it in my shows across the country, and people are always asking me about it. I had never recorded it, but it was perfect for these times, and it's called The Light of Love.
What is it about... Sorry, Razi. So, you know, yes. I find that with Save the Country, and it made me think also of your sister's new album, The Wall, both of you are very driven by causes, social issues. And what is your view of performers like yourself, like your sister, who say, look, we've got a platform, we need to try and change the world. And, you know, then there's the folks out there who say, no, just sing. You don't need to teach me anything. What do you say to them?
That's why I say I make my music interesting. Because within it is a positive message of love, and I have been very passionate with what's going on. I would love everybody in the world to be happy and taken care of, no poverty, no sickness. I would love everybody to have, and we should all be in harmony. This is what I long for. You know, years ago, I worked in the lounge in Las Vegas. And Elvis Presley, may he rest in peace, was in the main showroom. And some of his musicians played for me in my show. And I used to say to them, what is it that you love working with Elvis? And they said, because when he works, everything is a happening. It's a happening. And I couldn't get that out of my mind. Now, I was a much younger kid at that time. but all these years I've carried with me, that's what I want to do. And in the 80s, I was looking for my purpose in life because, you know, in this business, you're up, you're down, you're sideways. Some people go straight up and some people have to do a search.
I'm still looking for my purpose in life, Razi. Don't worry about that.
And my search was in 1984, where I was reading all kinds of books on the New Age. What is the meaning of my life? Why am I here? I get messages, and the messages that seem like that's the wrong message I'm being told, within my being. And so I did my search, and I found out, excuse me, that I'm meant to be, God willing, and I can, hopefully I can be, a healer. And I would love to heal the world. And my feeling was with the Elvis Presley thing that I saw myself maybe like on a mountain or somewhere where I was singing, and people came, and they didn't know why. All they know is that it made them feel good.
By the way, when he left the building, did they actually announce Elvis has left the building?
No. Okay.
I'm just sort of curious. You know, here you are.
No, I love the stories. I love the stories because people said that they were on the elevator with him and they admired a ring. He would take it off his finger and give it to them.
Really?
Wow.
Keep that in mind. Keep that in mind when you and I are in an elevator somewhere and I like your ring. You know, we're talking about changing the world through the song Save the Country, and it is available on CD Baby, but the truth is we want to share some of that song with our listeners, if you don't mind, Rozzy. So we're going to
listen. Not at all.
All right, here's a little bit of Rosalind Kind singing Save the Country.
Come on, people. Come on, children. Come on down to the Glory River. Down, gonna lay the devil down. We're gonna lay that devil down. Come on, people.
That is beautiful, absolutely beautiful. That saved the country.
As it goes on, it picks up and changes, as you know, because you listen to it, beats and rhythms. And there's like a Manhattan Transfer sound in there. I mean, it really goes crazy.
And that's why people have to go find Save the Country on CD Baby, because we're not going to play all 4 minutes of it here.
But it's a beautiful 4 minutes, I'll tell you that much.
Thank you so much. I'm so proud of it. I am so proud of it.
So talk about, will you be touring as a result? I know you've got a gig coming up in the Purple Room soon, but, we're in Chicago. How do we get you back to Chicago?
Well, who do you get? What are the clubs now in Chicago?
Well, we got an empty seat actually in the studio right now. Chicago. We got an empty seat in the studio for you right now. we could probably get somebody out for the next show too. Move them over for you.
Uh-huh. Oh, good.
You know,
good.
We actually. I have to tell you that we also have sitting in the studio with us. We do. He's a young gentleman named Blake Alexander, and he is a singer here, kind of the flavor of Michael Bublé and Frank Sinatra and those folks. So he came and we chatted with him before you came on. But I just, in listening to Roz Kind, I just have to ask Blake your response to listening to this is one of the great, great singers of all time.
Oh, of course. I mean, just hearing the small excerpt that I did hear, it's phenomenal. It just went through my body like no other. So give me chills.
Did it really, Blake?
Yeah, of course,
oh my goodness!
Yes.
You know, I sang in my lower register for the first time. I'm using my lower register.
Well, it was mysterious in the beginning and yet powerful at the same time. So, it's powerful.
Well, thank you.
And I thought it could be an influence. Hey, Rozzy, who were influences on your career?
Oh my God! Well, you may not identify. I mean, I loved Shirley Bassey.
I love Shirley Bassey.
I loved her drama and a lot of my singing and my words, I learned from, because I just loved her drama, and then she would open her arms and her gowns would go in the air, and I just loved her elegance.
You know, I just looked her up. I believe she's like 85 or so, and she is still alive. I think she's living in Australia. Yeah. I just looked her up. She's phenomenal.
Well, she is. She really is. How can we ever forget things like Goldfinger?
Diamonds are forever. Did you when you toured with your sister? Was that a joy? Obviously, it was a joyous experience for you guys. But was it something that you and Barbara said? We love this. Let's do it again. Or was that a once in a moment that we? I was there. I saw the concert.
She doesn't tour a lot, but that was a great. You know, we had never done it before, and since Jason started singing, it became a family affair.
Yeah.
So it was a lovely reason to do it, and I actually got to sing live with my sister in public, other than in private.
and with Jason. I was there. I saw you here. That you were in Chicago for that.
Definitely.
Just so amazing. So what do you like doing? Is recording something that you're all about? Is it touring? What is it that is, at this point in your career is important to you?
I'm a mix. I love when I'm in front of an audience, and I'm somewhat empathic, and my focus will go to somebody who I think doesn't look very happy, and I will sing at them to make them smile, to hopefully get a smile, make them feel better. But I love the one-on-one connection. I do look in the eyes of people who I can see in the front.
And by the way, your CD, Come What May, you signed it for me. You wrote Love and Light.
Oh, that's what I always write, sweetheart. I always, because I wish that to every one of us. I wish that to the planet.
Rosie, I pretended you only wrote that to me. So from now on, come up with something else that you write to other people. That is our thing.
Yep. Forget what I just said, Paul. I only wrote it for you.
The heck with everybody else. If you give Eric a CD, sign his, like, whatever happens to you. Who cares? I don't know.
Just put what I wrote on Paul's.
Yeah. Ditto.
Well, Roskine, thank you. First of all, congratulations on this new release.
Thank you.
Again, people
thank
can get
so
it on
much.
CD Baby and among other places, of course. And I'm going to keep my eyes open for that full CD. I hope to come out soon.
Oh, yes.
I've always admired you for so many years. You and your sister, you both are great.
I'll tell you, Paul, it's exciting because it's the first time in my whole performance history that I was like producer with my producer friend. The two of us produced it. We worked on the arrangements, and some things I even played, like native drums, which I'm not going to go into because that's a surprise on another record. I mean, but I really was involved in every way, which I had never, because, you know, when I was with a label, it was always them telling me what to do.
You've been bitten by the bug.
It's a lot of pride of ownership, too, for sure.
It's a lot. I didn't ask to be a producer. I wanted to be a performer, but, you know. This is an incredible experience, and it opened me up. And my fellow producer, Stefan Oberhoff, has been so inspiring. And what his music is magic and makes me want to soar.
Well, Roskine, thank you so much for joining us. We will, of course, keep our eyes out for that CD when it does drop. Thank you again. I appreciate it.
Please do.
Happy New Year to everybody on your side of the world.
All right.
Same to you. Let's hope for a much better world coming forward.
Thank you so much.
Just want to give a couple roses to a pretty girl I know. Maybe we can hit the matinee to a show. Oh, she says she likes simple things. Yeah, this I know.
Whoa, that, ladies and gentlemen, is Blake Alexander.
What a voice.
Oh, and then it comes in a little bit there. Blake is in studio with us. He not only is a performer, singer, restaurateur as well. Blake, tell us a little bit about that song.
So that song was just, well, it actually took about 2 years to write.
Yeah, you wrote it, right?
I was writer and co-writer. My other counterpart, brilliant, brilliant composer, his name's Adrian Ruiz, took part in that song. And, you know, he composed as far as the music goes. That all started off with me literally humming the melody into my phone. And he just took it from there. And, you know, I had my input with, okay, well, I want, you know, the strings to come in at this point. I want the drums to kick in at this point. But I still want it to sound old school, how it did in the beginning. You know, like you're at a...
Yeah, that was very kind of...
speakeasy.
Right, Rat Pack-ish,
you know,
for sure.
And then it just kicks in with that pop feel to it. So, you know, Ben One and one of my best friends, Steve Ford, they all kind of collaborated on some lyrics and stuff like that. And, you know, it was just, it all came together. But it took 2 years, but it is finally now where I wanted it to be.
So is the goal for you the CD that is created with all of Blake Alexander original music with writing partners, or is it the covers that you do of the Michael Bublé's and the Frank Sinatra's and those folks?
Actually, when I do come out with the EP album, which is about 5 or 6 songs, that's all going to be original stuff.
Oh, wow.
So
tell us, yeah, I always find it interesting, you know, we're kind of in the creative field. We write, we talk, we do that kind of thing a lot. And just out of curiosity, where's your inspiration coming from when you sit down to write a song?
Life, honestly. You know, I could be driving in the car one day and, you know, see some birds and the sun gleaming down through the clouds, and it just looks like God, you know. Just
how does
just
that song
speaking.
go?
I can't even think about it right now. But, you know, stuff like that would just hit you just out of random. And, you know, it just kind of goes from there.
And by the way, you also, you're multilingual. You also sing in Spanish. Is that right?
I do sing in Spanish, yes. I can understand Spanish perfectly, and I can read it perfectly. I cannot speak it perfectly, though, and I cannot speak it fluently. So if it's written out for me, so if I'm describing, you know, certain things that I wanted to say, it could be written, and I can read it like I've been speaking it all my life. But
is it easy to write, you know, like I've written a song for Eric. It's called The Top Rung of My Life. I just wrote that as I was sitting here. Actually,
it's beautiful.
Thank you. You haven't. That's just the title.
I mean, it could use a little work. That's why we got Blake here.
Yeah, Blake, take this on. It'll kill your next EP.
Like just the way the sun is shining off the lake and
on the top rung of my life. Yeah, that's just, right. I think it works. Hey, so when you write this stuff, do you maybe we all? I don't know. I've dabbled in writing. I don't know if it's very good and all that. But do you have to run it by people? Do you and sort of say, is this good? Do you trust yourself?
I do trust myself for the most part, but I think that all of us, I mean, in general, you have to have in these days a second opinion, a third opinion, you know, 150, 500 opinions before you can actually, you know, see if it's good or not, because it's not what I'm necessarily going to choose that's going to put my brand out on the board. It's going to be the public. So no matter what I think in my mind that I like, it's not about me at the end of the day. It's about what the public likes.
So I've got to take it over to Mark Roscoe. He's our fashion designer with tips for New Year's. But Mark, as Blake just talked about, it's what the public thinks. And I think of your work. And as I said, if people, you know, follow you on Facebook or other social media or your website, they can see the incredible designs that you do for women, men to come, but women now. So I have to ask you the same question, because I look and I think they're incredible. But do you design for this is what the public will like? This is what I think. Is it your inspiration? How does it start?
Well, it's my inspiration, but it often evolves when we're designing for someone as we begin to know the person that we're designing for and their personality is coming through as the design process begins. It also is governed by the event for which we're designing, the season for which we're designing, what role you're playing in the event that you're attending. So there are a lot of components with respect to what that ultimate design looks like. But the bottom line is, it's really about the woman for whom we're designing. And
this all started with your mom, as I remember.
It did. My mom was a plus-size woman, and she had difficulty finding clothes. And so it used to break my heart when she would come home from a shopping excursion empty-handed and in tears. And so I purchased a sewing machine, and I taught myself how to sew, and I started making clothes for her. And as she started, you know, feeling good about clothes that actually fit her, she started taking better care of herself. And that's actually how our brand began, because different women and different men who had heard about what we were doing from my mom thought, gee, I also have the opportunity to look as good as I possibly can. And so they started seeking us out and asking that we design for them. So that's actually how the brand began.
You know, Eric, actually, Mark is a lawyer by day, so it's not as though he went to design school.
That's what I was going to ask. You said you bought a sewing machine, you taught yourself how to sew. Right. Where did you get the idea that you could even do this?
You know, we were raised, I was blessed with a wonderful mom and dad. You know, we, instead of sitting around talking about people and gossiping, we shared ideas and we created things. And so it wasn't uncommon as we were, you know, at a young age, just making things at the dining room table. My dad was really good at architecture. And so we learned at a very young age to work with our hands. And you know, as it turns out, you know, architecture is really the basis of designing. It's finding the right silhouette for the frame that you're designing for, and so it came very naturally for me because that's what we were exposed to growing up. But, you know, as Blake said, there's kind of an innate talent that you have that sometimes you don't realize until you start tapping into it because of life circumstances that allow you the opportunity to do so. Obviously, I can't sing because when we were young, I'd sing in church. My mom would tell me to hum. So, I mean,
well, that's right. Blake can't make dresses.
I wasn't blessed with that talent. But, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, there are times when I'm sitting at the design table and I'm sewing, and we've talked about this before, Paul, and there are things that I know how to do mechanically that I've never been taught, that oftentimes I think, gee, where did I learn how to do that? And I've never learned how to do it. It just comes to me instinctively. So it's, you know, when you have a certain talent, it's a blessing to be able to pursue it and to you know, drive some joy through that.
Is it harder to come up with things on your own, or is it when somebody commissions, you know, a design, do they just say, hey, Do what you do.
Well, we,
or do you have a good idea?
We have, you know, I always encourage women to come to the table and men to come to the table with an idea. You know, I ask them to look through magazines and to see what, you know, their eye is attracted to. And oftentimes, you know, they come and they're spot on, but, you know, oftentimes the look that they're going for really doesn't work for their frame. And so, you know, we start draping fabric over their bodies and get them to understand that there are things that we want to camouflage, there are things that we want to accentuate, which are the positive parts of their body. And so that's where the design of the garment actually begins evolving. But it starts with a concept that, you know, this is kind of what I like, and we try to stay, you know, true to what their aesthetic is and putting our spin to it.
By the way, Eric, you've seen Mark's work. You don't even realize it.
Oh, no, I realize it.
At the I mean that. But our colleague, Micah Mater, has emceed things. She's gone to the Emmys, and she's worn Mark's cadet. She looks absolutely gorgeous when she wears it.
She's a beautiful woman, and I love designing for her because she allows me to just create. You know, she may have an idea for a color or style, but she'll say, make this, and she'll wear it.
You know, and Eric's a nice-looking guy, too, so I don't know if that's Eric, the, I know Eric, you just designed something for James Franco's brother, right, Tom Franco? So that's the movie world, Eric, and you're a step away from getting into the movies if you get a Mark Roscoe
design.
I'm
going to ask you about that when we come back right here on 720 WGN. Well, I wish we were opening a bottle of champagne, but it's close enough.
We will be.
Now, here in about a half hour or so, that is Blake Alexander, who is not only a singer, restaurateur as well. That's an original tune, right, Blake?
It is, yes.
He is obviously in studio with us. And we also have Mark Roscoe, who is here, a fashion designer. And first, I have to say, you guys look great for radio. Absolutely fantastic
Thank you.
Vests, ties, pocket squares.
Woo.
Of course, Eric and I are wearing the same thing because radio people can't hear us, can't see us, so we might as well say we're wearing the same thing.
But while we're on the topic, though, what are some things that you see, Mark, that people are doing, both men and women, that maybe we should not do anymore?
Well, I think a lot of it is just learning what looks good on your body. You know, it's about the fit. When we do custom work, we don't talk about size. We talk about, you know, what fits and understanding what looks good on your body. I mean, oftentimes when things look askew, you know, on someone's body, it's because it doesn't fit properly. Or people, you know, have a tendency to dress, you know, not appropriate for their age. You know, we have women who come in their 40s and 50s, and it's a great age for a woman. They're seasoned. They've gone through a lot, but they still want to, you know, wear the midriff like they did when they were 20. And there's a certain time when you have to say goodbye to that clothing and you know, embrace who you are and where you are in your life and find what complements, you know, that woman. And so, you know, those are the things that I, you know, that I encourage people to look at when we design for them. But, you know, I always say to them, no matter what we design for you and no matter how beautiful we make you look, it's still from what you bring to the garment. And I always say to people, your smile is your best accessory. And so, you know, teaching people that we could only change you so much. You really have to, you know, wear the garments and let the garment wear you.
I think one of the things that I definitely had to learn, especially once I got to Chicago, was the fit.
Right.
Because I think I was wearing clothes that were too baggy a lot because they were comfortable to wear. But once I learned the fit, I mean, that was like a game changer as far as the clothes I would buy and things like that. How do you tell people this is how you know it fits?
They know. You know, when you're trying garments on, we have sample garments that we try on, and especially for women, as we're creating the garment for them, they start feeling it. It's like putting on a pair of gloves, and you know when the fit is right. If it's pulling, if it's too, you know, if it's snug, you it's a sense of your body is telling you, you know, what is good, what feels good on you.
I know one thing, when I started, you know, getting fitted for clothes, my first initial reaction was, no, this is too tight. It's too tight. But now I can't imagine not wearing. And actually, the person that was helping me out, she said to me, "No, it fits."
Right.
Which was an interesting way of looking at it, I thought.
Well, and it is. And, you know, and the styles, you know, especially now for, you know, the younger men, Blake's, you know, age and Blake's size, you know, the jackets are shorter, the pant legs are a little bit, you know, more snug or a narrower fit, a 7-inch versus an 8 or a 9-inch. But you have to have the body for that. You know, someone who is 60 and my weight, you know, if I put that suit on that Blake is wearing, it just looks like I'm wearing my son's clothes and they're too small for me. And so, again, it's really knowing your body and understanding that what looks good on your body.
So you've got the men's line coming out soon. Yes. That's going to be known as Eli Rosco Design. Correct. Your partner, Dr. Eli Soto. I know Eli. I've met him, and he wears a lot of vintage clothing and all that. You mentioned earlier, you talked to Eric about, you know, well, you shouldn't wear certain things if you're beyond a certain age. The question I have for men is, it seems that sometimes styles come around. Why ties, they're wide, they're thin, they're wide again. As I said, Eli, who looks and pictures of him on your website as well, wearing these incredible vintage clothes from sometimes the 30s, sometimes the 70s. Sure. But it all works. Is it a different ball game for men?
We are making it different for men. You know, we're introducing, you know, more of a fashion-forward aesthetic in our new design. And it is bringing forward, you know, garments that you saw in the 20s and 30s and 40s, but making them more current. You know, the wider lapel is coming back. In Europe, it's already back. And so, you know, the peak lapel that was, you know, 3 inches is now 4.5 inches. And it's just a great look that, you know, in mixing plaids and stripes and you know, doing the pocket squares and the carnation, you know, accessories and the cufflinks. I mean, there are so many things that men can do to really jazz up an outfit you know, was, you know, not available in years past. That you know, our line is for a man with a strong sense of style and the confidence to express it, and that's what we're trying to get men to more feel.
Eric, keep plaids in mind the next time you're on TV.
I'm on it.
When you have that murder scene or something like that in plaid.
I'm not going to go with that one.
All right.
When you look at Blake, he is a younger man, and you look at his style. First of all, Blake, how did you come up with your style here? I wish people could see it because you look great.
Thank you.
But tell us a little bit about your style, because your sound is definitely speakeasy-esque for sure. So tell us about your look.
It all started with James Bond. My father introduced James Bond to me at a young age, and ever since I saw that on screen, I want to say I asked for a tuxedo for my ninth Christmas.
Sure. Yeah, we all do that.
And I would wear that thing to school. I would wear it to the grocery stores. I mean, I just loved
Felt good.
Yeah, you
feel
good.
Cool.
You feel good when you dress good.
Yeah.
And then when I perform, I believe that, you know, if my audience is coming to listen to me, they're respecting me while I sing. You know, dressing a certain way, you're respecting your audience at the same time. So,
Mark, you're looking at it. You're studying it. What do you see?
It's exactly what we're doing. I mean, he has three prints going on here in his jacket. You know, again, the peak lapel, that's about 4.5 inches wide. He's selected the perfect tie for it. Your tie should be similar to in width to the width of the lapel, and so he has a little wider profile on his tie. A real subtle print that goes with the, you know, a little bit more bolder print on his jacket, and then just this delicate striped shirt. And so he has three patterns with a pocket puff that is, you know, a solid fabric that just pulls it, you know, it's a great harmony in the look.
Well, he knows harmony.
Created. He does. Right? Absolutely.
Well, we are coming up on news time here. So before we get there, first, Mark, tell us where people can find you.
We can find us on the web at markroscodesign.com. We also are on Instagram. Our men's line is at Rosco Couture is our women's line, and at Eli Rosco, our men's line.
All right. And Blake, where can people come find you?
Blake can either be on Facebook if they search under Blake Alexander or BlakeAlexanderEntertainment.com.
And the restaurant, if they want to come for New Year's Eve and come join you for $20.19.
Blake Alexander's Hog Haven.
Hog, it's like barbecue, I think, right?
It's a modern barbecue. It's when I had the aspiration for it, I wanted to give the people a fine modern dining experience without the prices and amazing food. Family of four can come for $80 without drinks. So
it's incredible.
It's, yeah.
Yes. Did you grow up with in restaurants? Or I
grew up performing in a lot of restaurants, and eating, of course, in a lot of restaurants. I may not look at, like it, but
well, you're young. It'll catch up with you. Trust me.
So, but that was my vision and goal, was to give somebody an elegant dining experience with great food. And
you're performing that night as well. And then New Year's Eve, you're at the Merchandise Mart.
I am, and they can purchase tickets there at highsite.org.
All right. Perfect.
Well, great stuff.
Yeah, Blake, Mark, thank you guys so much for joining us here. We'll definitely be looking to see what comes next from both of you.
Thank you.
Very exciting stuff.
And I want you to record the song I wrote for Eric, The Rung of Life.
Oh, yes. For sure. Well, I mean, we're going to have to wait till he drives home to get some inspiration, to get some lyrics. I mean, you got the title.
I'll wait for that. The song will never get written.
Well, the first one was 2 years. I mean, come on. And welcome back to Nightside here on WGN, 720 WGN. I am Eric Rung, and with me is Paul Lisnick, and in studio now is Filet of Solo, which is quite a show, and we're going to get a little bit of it here.
This is really cool, Eric, because Filet of Solo, this is its, I think, 22nd year, guys, right? Been going on a long time. It celebrates the breadth of Chicago's storytelling, live, through scenes, through music, in so many other ways, but let's let them tell you about it rather than me telling you about it. Dorothy Milne is the artistic director of the Lifeline Theater and the co-curator of Filet of Solo. Dorothy, hi, and give us some history.
Alrighty, the festival started at Live Bait Theater close to Wrigley Field when they were active, and when they closed their doors in 2009, Lifeline Theater started co-producing with them and taking over where the location where we produce it. And this is an exciting year because we are also, besides producing it at Lifeline, we're producing it at Heartland Cafe in their event space, the former Red Line Tap, which will be the last thing that happens in that space. It's closing at the end of this year, and so Heartland Cafe is staying open, just that section, for us to do the festival there for the month of January.
And Dorothy, tell us a little bit about the show itself.
Yes, it is storytelling. It's first-person narrative, telling a true story that happened to me. There are people doing their first-time ever efforts at this in some of the group shows, and then, like, the guests we have tonight are long-term proficient people in the form that are doing one-person shows for the whole hour rather than a shared evening.
And basically, somebody gets on stage and they just tell a story. Once upon a time.
Well, it's nonfiction. Yes, it's Once Upon a Time, but this happened to me.
Right.
So, and by the way, this plays from January 18th to February 2nd. And by the way, we want a night of inexpensive theater, if I can say that, because it's only like $10.
$10.
And $50, and you can see the whole festival, right?
Yes, which is like 40 shows. So you can,
it's amazing.
You can see everything.
Let's have some performance. Let's see what you guys do. Now,
I don't know if I have my story ready yet.
Oh, well, you write it.
why don't we let them do it, and then I'll see.
Actually, if Eric does a story, maybe it could be buy one, get one free, and then they pop over and...
There you go.
Oh, I'm just kidding. He'd be fabulous. So, early on, McLaurin, you go by Earl.
Yes, I do.
Right? So, mm-hmm. Your story is called The Malt Liquor Diaries. So many choices, so many beers, right?
Yes.
Tell us what led to this story, and then if you would, share a little of it with us.
I am also a collective member of Second Story, which is a storytelling collective here in Chicago. And about, it'll be 10 years in January, I submitted a story to them about my relationship with my dad. And at the time, I was just like working through it. And they ended up taking my submission, and eventually it got programmed, and I performed it, and it was great. Then I became a company member, and as I continued to write, another story popped out. And at that point, I was like, I feel like this is going to be a trilogy. And I feel like this is going to be a one-woman show. 10 years later, I'm finally putting it together. So I'm really happy to be able to be here and honor my dad and share my story with you guys.
And let's hear a little bit of it. So this is going to be part of the performance we will see when we come see you. I know you're performing on January 19th and 26th.
Yes.
Right? So give us a little bit of the Malt Liquor Diaries.
All righty. When I was 4, my parents got divorced, and I was raised by my mother. Now, my mom has never tried to keep me or my sister, Treese, who's 8 years older, from my dad. But because I was only 4 when he left, I really I've really never known him as anything other than the persona of Early B. McLaurin. Early B, the B doesn't stand for anything, by the way. McLaurin stands around 6'2", has never weighed more than 160 pounds in his life, and can always be seen with a beer in one hand, a cigarette in the other, and a light slur with a straw hat precariously balanced on what I call the wild man. The wild man being his 1970s afro, which, unlike the nicely shaped afros you see on movies, features my dad's baby soft gray hair standing on end all over his head, a la Albert Einstein. So to me, he's always been this funky character, but never a real person. Alcohol probably had a great deal to do with that, but it's also made our relationship kind of simple. When we visit, my sister Therese does all the talking, and I nod where appropriate. I'm Early B. McLaurin, just look at all this pretty. He'd always say, flashing a toothy grin. Now, as a child, I knew this wasn't normal, but I never questioned him. Or Therese, or did anything, because I didn't have to. My sister's relationship with our dad, coupled with her big sister status and my young age, created a natural buffer that I've always leaned on to deflect the large purple elephant in the room, which, for all intents and purposes, is that my dad and I are kind of strangers to each other. Crazy, I know, but because he's always been under the influence, it never even occurred to me that our relationship would ever change. And then he fell.
Wow.
Wow.
Applause. Hit the applause button. So I've got
Ben, we got the applause button.
For the applause button. So Earl, I have to ask you, as I listen to that, and I know this continues on, that's just a small piece of it. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be tough parts, sad parts, funny parts. I'm just curious, this is your life. I mean, as Dorothy was saying, this, you're not making this story up. This is your life. How tough is it to put your life out on display for the public to see? The public you don't even know, because if somebody's going to buy a ticket, come see you.
You know what? Honestly, I would say it's easier to tell for me to tell a story in front of strangers, because I have an acting background. So being vulnerable in front of people who you'll never see again, real easy. But once I submitted to Philly of Solo and all the marketing stuff started happening, an email went around my full-time job. It's on Facebook. It's people from my hometown. I'm like, right now, I'm just trying to stay focused on the work, making sure that the stories are good and that I am doing all the people who've helped me put these stories together proud. And I'll worry about the nerves later. But that's one of the brave things about telling stories.
Are there folks in your story who are still around, still with you, who might come see this, and all of a sudden there they are and they're seeing themselves portrayed by you?
Luckily, my family is, they're used to it now, but my sister, when I went home for Christmas, she flat out asked me, am I in the story? I'm like, yep. I told her,
Merry Christmas.
I said, don't worry, I'm still perfecting your voice. I got to treat it like it's any other piece just right now so I can just get through it.
Dorothy, when people decide to do this, I mean, again, you created this so many years ago. What is it about the ability or the desire to share a part of one's life in this storytelling way that brings to the forefront for people? I would think it's difficult to do.
It does require courage. It requires more courage than playing a character. It's you doing yourself. You are the writer and the performer, and it's you're exposing yourself. There's something so powerful about the form where you see somebody who doesn't look like you. They're a different gender, a different culture, and then they tell a story that's personal, and it's very resonant and connecting of us, I think. And I think experiencing the form as an audience member makes you an addict, and I think it also has an addictive thing as a teller as well.
You know, one question that I want to ask you, actually ask all of you guys when we come back for break, is what you guys think makes a good story. So we'll ask you guys that on the other side of the break. Welcome back on 720 WGN Radio. My name is Eric Rung. I am with Paul Lisnick.
It's our last segment, Eric.
It is our last segment, and it's a good one.
Absolutely.
We've got some storytellers here from Filet of Solo. My question before we went to break was, in your eyes, what makes a good story? Dorothy, let's start with you.
I like a story where the teller learns something in front of us. I'm not interested in a story where they're telling me how somebody was a jerk to them. I'm interested in the story where the teller is the jerk who learns something. That's what I try to do for my
story. Does it need to be funny?
No, it does not.
Does it need to be tugging at your heart?
You know, a great story, but does both things.
And Earl, you just told a wonderful story.
Thank you.
That tugged at my heart.
I think what makes a good story for me is that it gives something to the audience member. Even though it's the story, you know, it's first person, it's about my life, I never want to have therapy in front of the mic or on stage. So if I'm not doing it for a purpose outside of myself, then that's not a story that needs to be told.
Now, our next guest, we could ask to answer that question, but I'm not going to make it that easy for him, Eric. We're going to make him perform.
Oh, my.
Oh, yes. Hi, Archie.
Hello.
It's Archie Jemjun, and you've written a show called, or a piece called, A Boy and a Diva, and you brought a diva with you.
I never leave home without a diva.
That's a compliment. That's a compliment. Shannon Wright is here. So, Archie, tell us, kind of set this up, and we're going to get a little music from Shannon on this one.
Yeah, so this is one of the stories in my show, and during my show, Shannon kind of comes in and out, because in my show, I kind of rely on divas to get me through life.
We all do.
Divas are my inspiration, of course, so.
That's why I got Paul here.
Yeah, what do you think? Yeah, it's my job.
So yeah, so this is one of the scenes where Shannon comes in and, like, you know, helps the story move along.
All right,
yeah, let's go.
All right. 2 months into dating, it was my birthday. Psych and I headed to Hopleaf, and while we drank our matching Belgian ales, he asked me to be his boyfriend. Archie, you're so hot. Our Nookie is amazing, and I love your creative side. Wouldn't it be cool if we had kids one day? Gabies? Did that man just mention gabies? I could suddenly picture myself with curly-haired Eurasian gabies. He was sending my ladyboy ovaries into a frenzy. I was even contemplating how to ask my sister for her eggs. I turned to look at the clock. 10:26 p.m., the moment my life had changed. I turned back to look at Psych. He had fallen asleep at the bar. The next morning, I went home, started the dishes, and put on my Whitney Houston playlist. I belted out,
"You give good love."
I gave an amazing rendition of,
"All the men that I need."
I skipped over,
"Where do broken hearts go? Can they find their way home?"
And I scared my cat dancing to,
"I'm your baby tonight."
As I was scrubbing a frying pan, I thought to myself, this is going to be my life. A gay, artsy housewife. Yes! If Psych and I lasted, I would never have to worry about bills again, because that's how life works, duh. Psych was my chance, and we were actually in love. He wrote my name in pancake batter one night after drinking. I found a self-help book in his bedroom drawer about how to be a better boyfriend. He always held my hand in public, no matter what the neighborhood.
All right.
All right.
Very nice.
Applause cue. I love that. I actually started, I got, "Our Nookie is amazing." I caught that line, and it kind of went on from there as well.
There was a lot of lines in there. That's great.
Yeah, great job, Archie.
That was excellent, and excellent singing as well.
Thank you, Shannon. Give us the impetus to this story, because these are truthful stories, right? So,
oh, right. So this
do you have babies or what?
I maybe soon, but not. My husband can't afford them quite yet. But this is a story based on this guy I dated for a long time, and we met on Adam for Adam, and we went out on our first date, and he kind of he passed out. He told me he had narcolepsy. And this story is really about, like, when you date someone, it's kind of like about the fronts that you put on when you're dating people, and how when they're slowly stripped away, you find out who those people really are, and sometimes you find out who you are yourself, you know, too. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what that story
is. Yeah, passing out on a date, that's pretty good.
Wow. And, you know, and I kept really on with it. That's not enough to turn me away.
So talk about the diva piece. Well, first of all, Shannon, so you played, it's obviously this support role to his story. Will she do various divas throughout the course of the piece?
Yeah, I mean, my main diva is Whitney Houston. So Whitney Houston appears a few times, but Madonna's in there, Lauryn Hill's in there. We have a little Paula Abdul as well, so...
We'll be friends.
Yeah. No share?
Yeah. No share. Maybe in the next version of this.
Okay.
But no, the first story is the best when she comes in as Whitney Houston and she saves me during a talent show. So
I just want to hear the Whitney Houston.
Why don't you sing the last part of Greatest Love of All?
Yes, go for it, Shannon.
And if by chance that special place that you've been dreaming of leads you to a lonely place, find your strength in love.
All right.
Get that along with the story. You get that incredible music.
Yes.
That and by the way, incredible.
You're performing that on January 18th at 8:30 at Lifeline and January 25th at 8:30
at
Lifeline.
Friday nights. Yes.
Wow. You know, if you can't make it, I could do some of those voices.
How come you only do it when the mic is off?
What?
Paul? I don't do it when the mic is off.
Well, I don't know. If Sammy Davis Jr. is your diva, I might be able to do that one and Anthony Newley. I can pull both those off.
I know Paul's trying to let you off the hook, but I'm not going to let you. Archie, tell me what you think makes a good story.
I mean, lots of things make a good story. What I always aim for when I'm writing a story is I want to make you laugh, and then I want to make you cry, and then I want to make you laugh, and then I want to make you cry. You are my victim a little bit.
You want to take me on an emotional roller coaster.
I'm into putting people on the roller coaster. Yeah.
So when you write these stories, are you writing for the audience or are you writing for yourself, knowing that the audience is going to come along for the ride?
I think a lot of the times I start writing for myself, but by the time I get to a version of the story that's for the stage, of course I'm going to acknowledge the audience and I want to entertain them and I want them to feel something and learn something.
Earl, same with you?
I was thinking that there's a point in editing process where there are certain things that have to just be said to the audience outside of I'm one of those performers. I do a lot of asides to the audience because honestly
I love that.
I can't figure out a way to make it into the story, so I just stop and I say, hey, by the way, this is the thing that I want to tell you. Okay, now back to the rest of the story.
Oh, that's awesome.
What is there when you guys are writing these stories, are you writing them as a performance piece, or are you writing them that possibly could get published in some sort of magazine, some online, wherever?
I have versions of my story that I do on the stage, and then there are versions of my stories that have been published on the Rumpus and different online magazines. So, yeah.
Obviously, it's a little different style of writing, right?
Yeah. I mean, when you're doing a story on stage, I'm very aware of how much an audience member can take in at a time, how much they can process. And when somebody's reading something, you have a lot more space.
Yeah, you can go back and read it.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly.
And Dorothy, are some of these, as this festival goes on for the several weeks, are some stories more family-friendly than others? Is there a warning out there for anybody, or is it pretty much anybody can, it's an adult-only thing? What do you think?
Well, here's the thing. A lot of the groups are collectives. Like, for instance, Earl and Archie are both doing one-person shows, but they're both attached to different collectives. Earl with Second Story and Archie with Outspoken and other groups. And we have 40-some shows, but we have 120 performers, so we can't guarantee that any show is family-friendly. Some of them are, but I don't really know, because I will be intimate with some of the one-person shows and stuff, but the different collectives sometimes have 7 different people every time they perform. So it's a huge range of, but we don't say it's family
friendly. So does that ever, I just have to ask, so a follow up, does that ever affect you? I mean, I'm thinking sometimes for my work on television or Eric's work, sometimes I think about, somebody could be seeing that and I want to think about how that message comes across. Do you ever look out at an audience and go, well, there's a 4-year-old, that's interesting. or young people, and is it a matter of, here we go, come along for the ride, or would you ever go, oh, I don't know?
I'm like, well, you brought your child, and now you have a teaching moment after this story. Because I don't.
Stay after for the after program discussion we'll be having.
I've actually had to edit stories for different events that, like, our stories may start out in a bar, but it may be reprogrammed somewhere where I can't swear, which is really difficult.
Like here.
Yeah. Well, you did a heck of a job not swearing.
Yes.
I mean, swearing it's really the rest of it.
Eric's finger was right near that dump button. You were ready for it.
No. Sometimes I've written stories where if it's a cuss word, it's there for a reason. and I'm not going to edit myself.
Well, words matter. I mean, yes. Especially whether you're writing for the ear or are writing, you know, for somebody to read. I mean, every single word matters.
It's precious, precious space. Don't any curator, any editor will tell you, don't write anything you don't plan on using, because you don't want to lose the audience in anything extra.
Mm-hmm. Dorothy, you've been a part of this for a while. So, I mean, what excites you about this?
It is one of my favorite art forms. Every time I go and see a show, I am thrilled and moved and laugh and cry. And I just never get tired of this strong bond I feel with the person telling the story, because no matter how different their experience is from mine, you know, the core human emotions we experience are all the same. And it is a very powerful and affirming shared humanity experience.
Just very quickly, you guys are storytellers, but you're also performers. Do you identify? Could I do your story, Archie or Earl? Could I do your story? Or would you say, no, it's my story. I need to perform it.
No. Sorry for that face. That face was no.
That's okay. It's radio. They didn't see it, but okay, it was good. A big smile.
The material is so personal. My cousin was actually in the Filet of Solo last year, and I directed her. And even looking through her material, there's no way I could even begin to do her story justice, because she lived.
All right, finally, you can get tickets at lifelinetheater.com. Lifelinetheater.com, theater spelled T-R-E, the proper way.
Yeah, and I was going to say, just real quick, Dorothy, tell us where people can find you.
LifelineTheater.com, and it's at Glenwood Avenue in Morris.
God, it's the same place.
It's the same about place. That.
The North Side neighborhood of Rogers Park. We're at two locations, Lifeline Theater and the Heartland Cafe event space.
Don't miss it. Great show.